Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, everybody. Man, welcome to the podcast, Greg. How are you?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Good, man. It's been too long. I don't know how long it's been, but it's been quite a while, brother. Yep. So I don't know how long we've known each other, but our paths have crossed many, many years back and forth.
Yeah, it's been, yeah, I think it's a couple of years since been on the podcast, but also like running into you in different college showcases and different events throughout Northern California and beyond. So, yeah, excited.
Yeah, NorCal guy. Yeah, I was, you were in Livermore for forever, right?
I was there for 6 years as a director of coaching.
Quite a good run.
Yeah.
Yeah. People don't understand how hard it is, not against Livermore or any league in the country, but people don't understand how difficult it is to be a director of a club with, the parents on one side, the board on the other side, the coaches coming at you on the other side, the players. And said there can be fine times where it feels like you're in one of those martial arts movies surrounded by 35 people and all coming at you at once, and you're having to defend from all angles. It's quite an experience.
Yeah, it's well, in that world, you start getting to know people's names and emails, and then attributing them to faces. At the end of the day, you know, it's working in youth community-based, you know, soccer clubs. It's all about what the community needs are, where the kids are, what their aspirations are, and then how we all work together to try and achieve those goals. So the one thing that I tell people is, you know, there's one immutable with parents is that they love their kids, and how they love them and how they support them. It ranges throughout the spectrum, but you know, I think it's important to keep that in mind, knowing what the players need, what they're looking for, and then what their families are looking and how to support them in a productive way, right? To get them along the path. So it's definitely from inception, you know, when they first come into the club at a young age and through the recreational programming all the way through to graduating out in high school and moving on. There's a lot of different, you know, things to consider for those children.
Yeah, no doubt. So how'd you get started into coaching in the first place? Was it the normal path of my kid's team needs a coach and I'm going to start, or how'd you get started?
Well, yeah. So when I was 15 years old, I broke my own leg. So I was taking a free kick, stepped hard. My muscle was stronger than the growth plate and it snapped the bone. So I was out for about 6 to 8 months. And during that time, my sister is 10 years younger than I am. So my mom needed an assistant coach / trainer for her rec team, which was my little sister's team, Barney's Backyard Gang. And so I started in as a trainer and a coach when I was 15. At that time, this was in the mid-90s when, you know, just as the World Cup was hitting and the market started to, you know, become a little bit more aggressive in terms of camps and clinics. And so I got started as a summer camp coach with the Zimmer Brothers soccer camps, which if you're from Northern California and you're approximately.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Anybody who knows the legends.
Yeah. So I did camp coaching for 5 to 8 years. That was my summer job. Did it through high school, through college. I worked after school programs when I was in college. And because of my injuries, I got into sports medicine and athletic training. So kind of went that direction route in terms of coaching. You know, at that time, you know, you were a paid trainer. So you'd come in and work with a team, you know, on a per diem type of basis as a contractor. Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't able to play because I had, you know, consistent injuries, but I was able to, to, be around the game, coaching it. And, I think going through growing up with parent volunteer coaches who had soccer knowledge, but not necessarily teaching backgrounds or, sophisticated soccer backgrounds, I got into it to try and help young players who were motivated like I was, to learn a little bit more about the game and be a little bit more intentional with it. So that's how I got into it and turned it, at that time it was a kind of a side, just a vocation hobby. And as I went through the process, it became, a part-time job and then a full-time job and, now a booming industry that I think, that we can support in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, now if for any players out there that think that maybe they can't see their life being away from the game, and for most players that means, I'm going to play in college and I'm going to play professionally, and which is great. I love it when kids have those aspirations. It's wonderful, but the reality is that, seven out of 100 are going to end up playing in college, and out of that, about less than one out of 100 playing in college, far less, are going to end up playing professionally. And of those, maybe one in 1,000 professionals will actually be able to, this is my retirement, this is my job, I've got enough money now. So the odds are astronomical of being set for life, which means, and even, hey, even, when we see, Pep Guardiola or whatever, he played professionally, made a lot of money, but still his career's, you're not ready to retire at 32 years old or 35 or whatever it is. So you got a lot of life to go coaching. So what I was going to say is your pathway. I know my son did the same thing. I think he had his, was allowed to take his F license at like 12, something like that, took his F and then got into camps with me and, eventually coaching younger teams. That's how he began his career. And hearing what you said just made me think about that. So I was going to say for any players out there, get your licenses young, get involved, go volunteer, go, ask coaches of younger teams under sevens or whatever. Can I help you? Can I learn? And it's a good thing to do in your spare time. That, along with refereeing, will teach you a lot about the game and prepare you for a career in soccer when you're older, if that's what you want, coaching.
Yeah. And I would echo that. Keeping the game in your life for, cradle to grave is the way I like to call it. There's a lot of
I like
entry
it.
points and as we go through this process and trying to, shoot for the stars and land on the moon, I never would have thought, when I was 15 and getting through this, that I would have, a soccer and sport career that I could sustain. And there's still a lot to be done. I think with with everybody, younger generation, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, as you all are coming through the ranks, there's going to be more players, and there's going to be higher need of having competent coaches and working with organizations and with communities, with schools, whatever it is to give back, because the game can give us so much. And that wisdom and that knowledge that you have to impart it to another is so important. And when I was younger, there was a huge market, if you will, or a vocation going into physical education and teaching in schools, and it's now become a little bit more privatized. So the access through it, there's you have to do a lot of self-motivated growth. And get that formalized training and finding mentors to guide you through that process. But as a director, the number one thing I looked at for young coaches in my programs was high school age players who were responsible, who could commit, who were, working on their communication skills, and just getting in and being community coaches. If I could have a youth club with 50% of club graduates, that would be phenomenal, because nobody knows the community, the club, like the player that has grown up through it. And I think that's a big thing for us as we are looking for the next generation of coaches and how we can support them.
That's great, man. That's really good to hear, and with good advice, man. What what brought you to how this how so how'd you decide to step away and because honestly, you and I don't know, I hadn't talked to you for maybe 6, 7, 8 months, and all of a sudden I turn around and it's like, oh, he's not in Livermore anymore. He's in Sacramento. Wow, that's a move. That's a change. How'd that come about?
Ironically, I've lived in Sacramento for the last 11 years, and so I was the director of coaching on the boys' side at Elk Grove, and then I got an opportunity to be a director of coaching in Livermore. Well, my wife's family is all from Sacramento. I have a great place in Midtown Sac, so I for 6 years commuted an hour and a half back down to
I didn't.
Livermore. So
Yeah,
I never lived there, but my sister and her family live in Livermore, so it's kind of like a home away from home. So it's her children's soccer club, and it got to the point, got married. It's nice to be on the road, but showing up at 10 o'clock at night, 4 days a
It's a
week.
brutal commute. People think it's close. So you look on a map and you go, it's not that far. It's a brutal commute.
I think I did 200,000 miles in 4 years. So from the pandemic to this summer, 200,000 miles in my car, lots of road time, and that's including, from just going to games and trainings, and anybody who knows this lifestyle, it's intense, right? You have to, you're married to the profession, and then when you find people around you who can support that, that's huge. So a big thanks to anyone who is the significant other of a coach or a
Amen.
director. All of you are all saints to understand what we go through with other people's children, or athletes, and what we feel we need to give them. And what in turn we need in terms of support. So, the change really came about just, can you find something closer to the home? As through this whole process, obviously, the sport landscape is evolving, college soccer evolving rapidly. And just noticing that, for me at Livermore, it was specifically, we had made a lot of progress. And for everything to be taken to the next level, it was time for somebody else to come in with fresh new ideas, local, could kind of carry the, take the baton and, carry the torch for that next step. And it was a good time for me to, to step back, and then looking at supporting parents. I think as the parents that are out there, there's a quote from Candide, which is a French philosophy book by Voltaire, but the last line is cultivate your garden. So and so the idea of living in Sacramento, this being my home, looking to kind of bring back and help support the Sacramento soccer scene, because I've worked in other communities and helped develop them, and so just looking how I can support the game and just the environment that we create.
Yeah, Sacramento, you know what? It has struck me through the years. My first introduction to the Sacramento market, being born and raised in San Lorenzo. So for those listening to this, go, where are you talking about? But we're talking about, Oakland, California, just south of that by 20 miles. And bringing youth teams into Sacramento, it always shocked me that the Sacramento soccer scene wasn't bigger than it was. You had these little pockets of Latino communities and maybe Latino-based home teams where you go, oh, that team's really good, that team's really good. But the big clubs that were holding the majority of the rec slash should be moving up players, it's like, man, they're not very good for as big as the city is, as big as the area is. It's not very organized. Some of the community colleges there have never been very organized and really couldn't get their stuff together, and I just couldn't figure it out. How is this possible in our state's capital with some of the great colleges there, UC Davis down the road from Sacramento State, it should be bigger than it is. It should be better than it is. It should be more organized than it is. And I've never been able to figure out, I've never studied it, but why? And this is no knock on any one organization, but anybody who's lived in the state or played teams knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's not a big secret that, you get these small clubs like Elk Grove, it's a suburb of Sacramento, but it still can be almost an hour away from downtown Sacramento, depending on the time of day and traffic. And it's its own community. And you see some of these clubs that are more organized and more successful than the bigger clubs coming out of the big city of Sacramento. What do you think that's attributed to? Or maybe you disagree. I don't know.
So I got here 11 years ago, and so I moved. I was a director, youth director at Ballistic United, Bay Area. A lot of history with that club,
Big club, big history.
and I got the opportunity to come out to Elk Grove, and specifically because the Sac Republic was coming online in the USL, and it was their first season that they ended up winning the USL championship. And the whole reason of moving up into Sacramento, A, similar to being from the Bay Area, Sacramento is almost like a state in and of itself. It's separated from everything else. So I came up here, and the thing that struck me the most was the diversity of just the population, every demographic taken care of.
Yeah,
Now,
different than
I would say,
Pleasanton.
Sacramento is, I would say, tribal. I think that would be the best way to describe it, is that there's so many pockets of different populations that it's very difficult to kind of come in together. But I would say in the last 10 years that I've seen, the clubs that are in the area, I think in the different regions of California, Northern California, Sacramento has the most clubs of any by dozens. So there's a huge population and diversification in those clubs. Some are really small, but and some are a lot bigger. I know when I came into Elk Grove, we had 105 competitive teams, right? And 5,000 rec. So, and this was a city that I had never really heard of, and it was 100 competitive teams coming from the Bay Area. So, with the advent of ECNL Boys and Girls, of the GAs, of MLS Next, I think the Sacramento soccer scene has organized itself. I don't know if you're familiar, but I think there's a 10 or 12 field complex that's opening up in Roseville, I think, this upcoming weekend.
Yeah, I saw that
There's
on the, it popped up in my feed on Facebook. I saw that.
And Rancho Cordova, which is just east of central Sa Sacramento, is building an arena for a professional indoor team. So, and they'll be playing in the MISL in Rancho Cordova. And so they're going to have concert events, MMA events. It's connected with Uriah Faber and some other big sport tourism, sport leisure development projects. So I think Sacramento is coming together, but it's still, I think it still has a lot in terms of the ground level, grassroots support for parent coaches, young children who are coming out of that. But there are big things. When I was in Elk Grove, we were part of a project with the charter school in Elk Grove. And it ends up now that a variety or a lot of the Sac Republic Academy players attend this school that we helped put together. We have Sac United actually has it as their kit sponsor. So there's some school and scholastic support for these types of programs. So I think it's growing. I think it's growing. It's organizing, but yet there's still so much work to be done because, as you mentioned, you get caught in the weeds and the day-to-day, and at the end of the day, just want to see children play, and then those who are high aspiring, getting the support that they need to get to that next level. And I think that's a big one. As yeah,
Yeah.
go ahead.
I think it makes sense. No. All right. Well, talking about the Sac Republic, what tell me, have you noticed changes in Sacramento since the Republic came in? And they've really, anybody who's followed USL soccer, they have done a fantastic job. They made a massive run in the US Open Cup 2 years ago, maybe. And they typically do very well in the US Open Cup, and they beat MLS teams, numerous MLS teams, numerous times, and almost won the whole dang thing. I think secretly someone in the MLS is going, please don't let this happen. Please don't let them win. It just, I'm not sure it would look good, but how we were all rooting. I've got so many friends that have been involved from, Zimmers to Jean Duchateau and other friends that have been involved with the Republic. So we've followed them very closely. And what changes have you noticed in that community having a professional team in Sacramento?
So when I first started out, again, they were just coming online, and the DA, the Development Academy, was being created. Sac Republic decided that they were going to have a youth academy underneath their full professional team. And it was in the beginning, we were part of a group. They called us the Big Six, I think it was, but it was the six largest competitive clubs in the Sacramento region that were looking to support and help frame how they were going to go out into the community. It was very we were really very optimistic on how it would infiltrate from the top down into the entire region.
Right.
And just like anything, grassroots politics and things kind of created some fractures within that. That said, the Republic has done a really fantastic job in terms of community outreach. And one thing that they've done really well is creating these urban play centers. So around the city, I think they developed 14 futsal courts throughout the city. So these are open play areas where kids from the community can go. I know they have some community camps and events that they do. And actually, one of the projects I'm involved in is running a futsal organization out of one of these sites. And they helped with Black Players for Change, with US Soccer Foundation, and a couple of others. They built four courts side by side, which in Northern California, I don't know of any other outdoor built to play futsal courts, but it's right in a lower income part of the city, and just creating those avenues for play. So in terms of reaching out and connecting with the community, I think they've done a pretty good job. I still think that within the soccer community, can we come together even more so, for the community, with the World Cup coming in 2026, with how, the viewership that we're hoping, but with the prices, as have you seen in tickets, is there needs to be a real big grassroots, local, viewership to create, a passion that is going to be self-sustaining. And American culture, just as you know, is really fast-paced. It's, what's happening tomorrow type of thing. Not a lot of forethought into what's going to be coming on board. And a good example, I went to the FIFA Club World Cup games. I went to four different games in LA, Atlanta, Charlotte. And what I noticed was just there was some energy, but there was a missed opportunity in really growing the sport for those who are not, soccer enthusiasts, right? Not bleeding it out. And I think that's an important piece that Sac Republic and all other, semi-professional collegiate organizations, we have to do a very good job to not miss the opportunity. For the men's game, which is diversifying at the semi-professional level right now. And then with the Women's World Cup being hosted in 2031, there's a lot of, sweat equity that needs to go in to creating opportunities for us to really, embrace this cultural renaissance within sports, but within soccer in particular.
Yeah, a lot of work to do. How's the how have the futsal courts in that community been received by the community, like the people who live in the neighborhoods? How's that been received?
Yeah, I would say sparing usage because futsal is obviously it's five a side. So, when you're trying to take your 11v11 team and you've got, 16, 17, 18 players and we're playing 5v5, that means 6 to 8 kids are sitting out, right? So one team can complete one court. And so it isn't utilized in an organized fashion where clubs are specifically booking out time, energy, effort. If I go back, maybe I think it was about 6 or 7 years, one of the clubs in Sacramento had their own futsal facility, two indoor courts side by side. They were running it, they wanted to use it for training purposes, and the pandemic hit and they ended up just getting rid of it. There's a couple other clubs who have built indoor facilities, but utilizing these outdoor play centers, anybody who works in parks and rec, works in city government understands the lack of usage of these things that our communities pay for, right? And
Are these
it's
open like a basket like a park basketball court where anybody can walk in
that.
and play at any time?
Yeah, there are very all these futsal courts are open, so it's first come, first serve, just like a tennis court would be. The
Right.
one that I work through is a simple rental because they use a third party vendor. So I can book time specifically, but these are open play areas within the community, and it's they're not utilized, I think, as much as they can or should be. And I think it's a matter of understanding, what is there, how to organize it, and more importantly, having, parents, families have that parks experience where, these futsal courts that at least in the Sacramento area are not built in the in the suburban communities, right? These are in low income urban areas where there are a lot of, potential social problems and issues, and this is a way to connect back with and get the community out there. And so the lack of utilization, I think, is less about the knowledge and just and being able to implement programming that supports the kids of the community. But when we anybody who lives in a a family-based community, kids are not playing out in the street in quote unquote closed bubble safe spaces. And so now you're talking about going off-site or away from the home into a open park area, and it's even less. So that's where this over-organization of youth sport has caused some issues, I think, in terms of community development. And it really takes a movement of the community to celebrate it and that it's going to turn corners. So it's definitely, it's definitely a lack of awareness, I think.
Yeah, it's something that I've noticed in my travels to, Argentina and Colombia and Spain and England and the different countries that I've been to, that I've noticed that there are courts set up and kids are playing. It's just part of the culture, and as long as I can remember over the past 25 or so years of 30 years of my career, people have asked me, when will soccer, really blow up in the US? When will it become, a major sport, not just the fifth most popular or fourth most popular, depending on what poll you see? And I've always said it has to do with culture. And I know my grandparents didn't even know what soccer was. My parents would just as soon as watched underwater basket weaving than watch soccer. It was a foreign sport, and now that's the only sport I ever played, really, growing up. 1 year of baseball, but I sucked, so I just stuck to soccer from an early age. And then my kids, and now my grandkids. So my grandkids, when they come over here, and on a Saturday morning, it's soccer on television, is the first generation where it's they don't know anything but soccer. And I'm 60, gonna be 63. And it's that's what it's gonna take. And it's probably gonna take one more generation at least past that. So another 20 years or so. We keep saying that every 20 years, one more generation, one more generation. But it has gained ground. Greg, I remember very vividly telling my wife when we were first married and we'd watch television, I said, someday I would like to see a television commercial that doesn't feature just baseball or football or basketball, where the commercial, whatever it's for, right, has something soccer related. And you're starting to now see that over the past 10, 12 years. You know, if it's a Subaru commercial or whatever, the mom's taking the kids to soccer practice. You know, it's not baseball. Or if it's a drug commercial, whatever. It has to do, there's some soccer involved. It's one of the clips. So, you know, for those that are negative, you know, shoot, you have no idea where we've come from. You couldn't find soccer on television 25 years ago. I mean, literally, you couldn't find it. You couldn't get it on deep cable. You just couldn't find it anywhere. Not highlights, nothing. And so we've come a long way. It's getting there, but it is culturally based. And it is, you know, my grandfather played, his dad played, you know, it's got to be that, you know, my great grandfather played in college, you know, it's got to be that kind of thing. And we're just not there. It takes time, man. It takes time.
I would say so. I've had every job in the physical education world you could possibly have. And one of the, deciding factors of moving away from being a club director was this need at the elementary school level to get more kids active and moving, and to be, to be aware of what it takes just from a recreational level of becoming active. The one thing that I would say is school sports, right? Whether it's high school soccer, middle school soccer, and then, essentially elementary school soccer is creating programs through schools where every child has to go and be, and creating the culture at that point. Because I think what's going to happen, or what has always happened, there's two different factors that influence the child: the family and their schooling. Those two, from an early aspect, those are the ones that are going to rear them. And so, a perfect example: why are you a an athletics fan, an Oakland A's fan? Well, I was born in Oakland. It was the Bash Brothers when I was, 8, 9, 10 years old. They were in the World Series, and that's how it was part of the family. I think with soccer in particular, is that we as a culture are looking towards international leagues because they're at a higher level, and not celebrating our local heroes as much in a way that's happening at the grassroots level. So I'll give you a great example. If I was to pick, the starting 11 for the Republic, I could maybe pick out three or four players personally, and I'm a soccer guy. But it's because it's not always up in your face, all the stats, every single thing on TV, pushing it into the media about it is not there. And I think to grow the game, you have to grow it locally. And you have to celebrate your local superstars. So, for example, in Sacramento, Rodrigo Lopez, Roro, everybody who's in Sacramento knows him. I think he's 37, 38 years old. He just played his last games and he's retiring. He is a local legend. He helped bring the championship at the beginning. He left and played in Mexico for a little bit, came back and played for the Republic, and now is working in some programs locally. I think we, as educators of the game, we have to know a lot about our local success stories, what is happening in here locally, and build that as much as that, that billion-dollar, international quotient. And I think when you start, recognizing the reality, and this is probably where it comes from, is There are many, many players who are 16, 17, 18 right now in local communities who can be a part of a semi-professional team locally. They can help build programs and fan bases in a more local environment. And I think that as the casual spectator, is we need to celebrate that. We need to kind of push a little bit more of our efforts at the youth game into the semi-professional game that's Luth, because at in all reality, if you're talking one in 100,000 making it pro, right? There's maybe one in 1,000 that can play semi-professional locally, or even, one in 100. And so now we can, we can give children, young adults, actual pathways to local competition where they're playing for some level of importance. Because, I've worked with a lot of very talented children, and the number that have made it all the way to the top, it's one for every 100,000, not one for every 1,000. So, I think it's important that we're supporting our local communities, that clubs are shaping their environments around that, that those entities are also giving back, right? Making connections. But at the end of the day, all of this is a business model, right? So soccer has gone from a hobby or a passion into more of a business-based model. So how do we navigate that, right? Not that it's good or not that it's bad. It's just how do we navigate it in a very fast-paced world that we live in?
Well, it's a twofold reality. The reality is that fields cost money. Even if you own your own field, there's maintenance and they're not cheap. And even a grass field can cost $1 million to put in it with the proper drainage and all of that, million plus with proper drainage and all of that and fencing and all the things that you need and the goals and the, yeah. And then you've got the maintenance, right? And then you've got the insurance and then you've got, then you've got referees, and referees get paid something. Yeah, they should, and they do. And uniforms and all of those costs. I mean, it drives me. People go, pay to play is so wrong in the United States. It's what's wrong with everything in Europe. They don't pay for it. It's like you're comparing Apple's culture to an orange's culture. It's two different things, and it's great to see what MLS has done with their academy teams, what the Quakes do, or what FC Dallas does, and those kids don't have to pay. But that's not, that's not the beginning of it all. As you said, you're so spot on with it's beginning with the elementary aged kids in your local communities. And as I don't know if you follow Tom Beyer or not.
Yeah,
On
of
Twitter,
course I
but
have.
he's fantastic about this. He says he's got a phrase that so soccer begins at home. A and it's I'm starting to get videos now of my grandkids just goofing around with the soccer ball, not really, just playing with it. Just playing with it. My kids will send me a video. They know I'll get a kick out of it, but they're just playing with the ball and they're learning at 2 years old just to kick a ball, not because somebody wants them to be professionally, because that's what you do with a soccer ball. You kick it and you throw a baseball and you dribble a basketball and that's just what you do. And it's getting that's the beginning point for parents out there, young kids maybe listening to this, or grandparents of that listening to this. It's just fun. It's
Yeah, and
just fun. It's just play.
it's the old adage, like go play catch in the yard with your dad, your grandfather, your brother, whatever it is. Getting around it all the time. Working in elementary schools like I have, the one thing that I notice is kids don't know how to organize themselves to play effectively and safely. So I'll give you a great soccer example is that, soccer balls are pretty light in terms of, when you get to young kids, the one thing that every kid can do is kick the ball, right? Doesn't take a lot of skill. Ball comes and just kick it. Right. And in unskilled environments like a recess, the ball is going to be lifted up and it hits somebody in the stomach. It hits somebody in the nose. And it becomes dangerous because they don't know how to play. So within a couple of, so I work with, and I have a local schools program, the National Academy of Athletics. But when I go and do schools programs is I bring futsal balls. Why? Because they're heavier, they don't
Yeah,
bounce, they're
they don't like
very
the
hard to
bounce.
lift. And if you kick it with your toe, it's harder, so it doesn't feel as good, although it is a skill. And so going in, I think the key is projects so that I don't know if you've heard of the MLS Go. Have you heard of that?
No,
So
I
this is
don't
a
think I have.
recre yeah, so this is recre it's a recreational soccer sponsorship or collaboration with MLS where all the teams in the league get MLS type jerseys. So the Timbers, the Revolution, Austin FC, whatever. That this league is MLS Go League. One thing that I would love to see, especially for a smaller market like us, I don't really think kids of Sacramento are going to be, going to a lot of Earthquakes games, right? It's 2.5 hours from Sacramento.
It's a long
So I
way.
would love to see USL, if you guys are out there, USL Go or something like it, because with a Sacramento market where we are, playing in the USL Championship and things of that nature is having that same environment to connect the players to the game that they can see at a professional level locally, right? They don't connect well with MLS. Maybe on TV they do with the EPL, La Liga, Serie A, Liga MX, whatever it is. I'll even throw it out there, Liga MX in the Latino base. I would. A USL Liga MX like league with uniforms and things like that. I'm throwing it out there. It's a great idea, and I'll be the one to head it up. But I think that's where the connection is, and any of the players, who are listening to this or parents of players, I guarantee that they fell in love with a team early, and the work that they did at 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and then becoming self-driven after that's what makes them successful.
I
But
couldn't
first, you
agree
have to
more,
fall in
man.
love with it. Like, they
Couldn't agree
have to.
more. If people just think back when, well, I don't know. Those of us that are older, Little League was always one team was the Mets, one team was the Yankees, one team was the A's, one team. And I don't know if they do that anymore. They don't do it here where I live, but that's the way it was, and that's kind of how you became a fan. And hell, our first youth team. I was trying to think. I became an Arsenal fan because we were trying to think what would be a pro team for our kids to follow. We wanted our kids to start watching soccer. And we looked at all the names and I saw the Gunners. I said, what little boys team doesn't think that that's kind of cool? A cannon's kind of cool. I think they'll think that's cool. And that's how I became an Arsenal fan back in 1989, I guess, something like that.
And if you look at it now with the WPSL, so Sac Storm, right? National champion, national finalist the last 2 years. There's the exact same thing for the women's game, right? That the women's game landscape is diversifying extensively. And so for players to connect to that environment, NWSL, all the different avenues, I think it's really important. If we want kids to be going towards college is if that's the environment you want, then everybody is a college, right? So great example, my wife is a first grade teacher. Every class is named after a different university. It's a college prep in a
Oh
low
yeah,
income
cool.
Title I area. And her team is the Sac State, or her class is the Sac State Hornets, right? So every one of the kids, like they have their little Hornets chants that they do, and they're first graders, right? Then buzz, buzz, buzz. I don't know what it is exactly. My wife went to Sac State. But it's trying to get you to aspire to get into that tier, right? And I think it's really, if we're going to take the next step, it's one thing that when I was at Ballistic United, the recreational program, each age group had a different internet or international domestic league that they operated with. And I think U5 was MLS and then U6 was La Liga. So each one of the rec teams drew names out of the hat and that was their team name. So they were Atletico Madrid, right? They were Portland Timbers. And at the beginning of the season, they did a parade downtown, and it was a Halloween-esque parade. And I still remember there was a team that was the Portland Timbers, and they had the mascot of the Timbers is Portland Joey. So we had all these little boys with fake beards, styrofoam hatchets, or axes marching down the street. And it was phenomenal, right? And so it really celebrated the culture of the game. And I think that's a great start to what it is, right? It's, costume-based imagination. On the other end, at Livermore, we had an end-of-the-year all-star event that was called the Fusion World Cup, and which was by far my favorite event. I think it's this Friday is what they do, but you have 1,000 parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles who attend this recreational all-star event, and each team is named after a different country. So we have England versus US and France versus Germany, and it was Brazil versus Argentina. And the parents would make signs, and it was by far the most raucous that those fields would get. And this was the start of something for these kids. And so when we talked to our graduates, and what was your biggest memory within the club? 50% of them was their World Cup all-star experience. They remember that that was the thing that got them excited about soccer. They were recognized for their talents, right? And that got them excited, and it was something that they could, they could put their hat on. And so the more at a community level we can create those types of events, not just for selection-based kids, but for all kids, that get everybody fired up, I think is the most important. So, and not everybody is a soccer player build like me. I'm 5'6", right? I'm left-footed. I was quick and fast, but little. Soccer was my game. But there are other sports that we can latch to, right? So I think it's as the game as sport becomes a little bit more difficult to access 3 p.m. and later, I think we have to get back to the schools-based initiatives, working and doing outreach there from 8 to 3 p.m., which is what my organization really is looking to focus in on, to get high school, college, post-grad athletes to come and work in those programs because they are the local heroes, whether they know it or not. And
Yes, they are.
there's a potential for a career coming out for them. And I, there's this look at me social media, personal branding aspect that I think a lot of these kids are starting to become very, very good at. The NIL rules and how they can become a brand is guiding them through the process, but also giving them realistic work experience to create their platform. And I think as now, what I would call the a middle generation. I'm not the older and I'm not the younger, but in that middle generation is supporting the next wave of those who work with athletes, understanding this evolving landscape, and knowing and understanding that I want when I coach players, I want to see them playing at 20, 25, 30, 35, 55, right? Can we create these opportunities for all tiers and all levels? So I think that's a big one in terms of adult recreational soccer as well. So having, indoor leagues and things like that, or outdoor leagues, bringing community together.
Yeah, well, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, but you've already given some great advice, is what advice you would give to people that want to be directors of a club or think that that's what they want to do. But man, that's a solid start. That's a really solid start. Any other advice you have to young coaches out there that think that this is what they want to do and want to move up in the club structure?
Well, and I think you and I have talked about this a little, quite a bit. So when I was in graduate school, I was at Chico State during the Chris Wondolowski years, which they went all the way to the national championship. He ended up going pro. I was coaching with the women's team, and I started a men's club soccer team. And this was in 2005. 20 years later, now the league that we were a part of, I ended up helping support. We grew to 135 men's and women college club teams. And now there's a national platform that is August to April, which we support. So there's a, you know, there's a fall competitive season and a spring competitive season. And what I would say for everyone out there who's a part of a club, who has kids, the thing that makes me the saddest is that 13, 14, 15, players who think at 11, 12, they're going to be pros or they're going to play in college, stop
Sure.
losing hope. And when they're 15, 16, they're starting to think, where do I want to take my next step in my life? I'm 18. Is it junior college? Is it college? Am I looking to get into the workforce? I think too many kids give up on that dream of playing collegiate soccer, not knowing that every university, every major university has a club team that in some way is supported by the school. Now, the interesting thing, so I went to the Sac State tryouts in, I think it was in September. They had 100 men trying out for a 25-man roster. Okay. But in college soccer, it's self-funded, it's self-promoted, it's driven by the students. There's, although 25 players made it, there's nothing that said the next 25 couldn't create a second team and the next 25 a third team. It's just a matter of resources and you know how much how it takes a lot of organizational skill to be able to do that. But as somebody, you know, these those are the club athletes are the ones that I'm looking to hire in for my youth sport programming. A, because I know they're organized. I know they're, you know, they're not going 6 days a week within their sport. They're not traveling across the country. So I think for college soccer, the idea of what college soccer is and the reality of what college soccer is something that is really important. And knowing that, you know, very few of you are of you can make it all the way to the top, but almost everyone with the right passion, energy, you know, grit and understanding can be sitting where you and I are, right? And like I'm not saying there's massive amounts of skill to go in and be a coach, but there is a lot of skill in learning how to work with children or young adults or you know, semi-professional collegiate athletes, players. And I think the key is just don't give up, right? So there is like you may not want to play at the NCAA level or the NAI level, but junior college, you know, as you saw just recently, right? You know, going to junior college doesn't go against you for your 4 year. Is that
Well,
correct?
it no, not
Yes.
correct. Yeah, and
Not correct.
there's a yes and no. It's correct, but it's not correct. So there was a temporary 1 year exemption that happened this year if you were already in the NCAA and if this year your eligibility would have expired because in the past you used up a year of your eligibility in junior college. And then there was the PIVA ruling, which a football player sued for the right to not have his junior college eligibility counted against his 4 year, and he won, but that was only for one athlete. Then there was a second athlete that won, but what we can't do, and I'm really glad you brought it up and gave me the opportunity to say this, because I haven't talked about this lately, but what we don't want is kids and parents thinking that for sure when I go to junior college now that I will not have that count against my 4 years later. That ruling has not been determined. Might it be? Maybe. The NCAA is going to have to get sued another 100,000 more times. But right now they're not ruling in that favor. They temporarily stayed off some lawsuits by granting a 1 year exemption for the year of 2025/26, this school year, and then we'll see what happens this next year. Because there's no doubt the lawsuits will continue to come, because in football and basketball, there's too much revenue sharing money and too much NIL money, and there's some unbelievable junior college athletes across the country in all sports. I mean, we're talking about true. Will make a living at playing professionally, class athletes playing in junior college, always has been and always will be. You know, it's not one out of 10, but it's not 1 out of 10
Yeah.
at the power four level either.
Yeah.
But there's so the lawsuits will continue to come. NCAA will be forced, I believe, at some point to make a permanent ruling. And I do believe that it is a possibility that they determined that what you did in junior college has nothing to do with us. It has nothing to do with us. We're going to rule on what happens with your eligibility within the NCAA only. I mean, there is an argument to be made, Greg, that it's a little crazy to say what you did in other arenas of organized sports is going to translate over to our organization, being the NCAA. But we're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's yeah, it's
But it
pretty
doesn't
I
mean that
mean,
junior college, your point's not valid, that
yeah.
junior college is an outstanding opportunity to get a, in many states, free education. And you can bank that money. Just had this conversation with the client the other day that they had a $20,000 a year budget, which means they can't look at schools that are going to cost them 30 grand. They don't have the money. But if they were to go to junior college and it was to cost them nothing, they can now take that 40 grand from the first 2 years and then spread that over and they'll have now 40,000 for the next 2 years. So now they can go to a maybe a higher level academic institution or a school that they couldn't have afforded before because the first 2 years were done at a junior college. And there's not an employer in the world who says, yeah, you graduated from Harvard, but your first 2 years were at a junior college. Therefore, your graduation degree from Harvard is null and void, and I'm not interested. That's not how it works.
I would say, going back, if I was, at the same level, looking at what I was doing, there are a couple of things is going to a junior college and working for a local sport entity while I was trying to get my AA in kinesiology. So I would get the academic background, I would apply it in the environment, and I would live at home. And so I had a little bit of ability to save money and learn the environment in where I'm from. Or if there's that academic opportunity to go directly into a 4 year, is, am I able to play, at the highest level at the school, whether it's NAIA, whether it's NCAA. Or and but if that academic, scholarship package is right for me and my family, my future, is if I can't make that team, is there a club team that I could be a part of? And the number of players that go from the club team to the college team in the spring season is high. The number of NCAA and AA athletes that go back down into club because they're player 23, 24, 25, and they can't handle the time investment versus the lack of participation. So there's a there's that. And for me, I would have been the president of a college club. I went to Loyola Marymount, played for 2 years there, got injured again and dropped out, but there was no club system. So I played intramurals and then I worked in soccer a little bit. It's a great, fantastic opportunity that the kinesiology world, with technology is going to continue to grow. And in an AI world that we're going in, jobs, professions that work directly with other humans and their human development, they are not going away. You cannot replace a coach, a teacher, that with AI. It's just not possible. You can complement it, but it's not replaceable. Because those soft skills are so important as we go through this whole process. So, and there's so many different jobs and vocations. Like I said, if you love sport and you want to make a career out of it, don't think you have to be the athlete on the field to do that.
Right.
You do not need to be the athlete. Find what supports the athlete. For every, Landon Donovan, there's 1,000 people who work in and around Landon Donovan, whoever for. For
Right.
me and him, for Trinity Rodman. right? A brand in and of herself. There's thousands of people who are affected by that person and have a living because of that person. So, knowing, understanding that, I think is the key. And it's about creating a community and realizing we can do this together. Coaches banding together, organizations, communities banding together to make a, you know, make a more connection locally, not globally. I think we went from only local to now this idea of global connection, which we've abandoned local connection. And I think we have to go back to local connection to make local impact that will occur on a global scale.
Yeah, it's that old saying, think globally, act locally, and it's I that's spot on. That's good advice. Now, I'm so glad you brought up club soccer, because and people look, what we do for a living is we help kids get into college soccer, and so the advice of to a lot of kids is club soccer is where you belong. Seems maybe counterintuitive to some, but at the end of the day, I'm just here to help kids, man. We're just here to help kids figure out
Well,
what the next step of their life is, and I don't care where it is. And club soccer is, you get kids that I've got a kid right now. His dream school was MIT, and he very close. I mean, he had 1590 SAT. So I mean, he was right there, and his grades were right there. But the kids getting into MIT have a 1600. And that 10 points wasn't going to allow him to go in, plus maybe some other the factors of where he was raised and who he was, his family background, et cetera, didn't allow him to get in. And at the end of the day, the decision was to forego the college offers that he had on the table to some very, very good schools to accept the offer to go to Cal Berkeley. But as good as he was as a soccer player, he's not good enough to play at Berkeley. And I told him, he realized it, connected him with the coaches there, and they told him no. So he's playing club soccer there. So he's going to his dream school. So, in his case, he wants to be a rocket scientist, literally. And what's the point in giving up that dream to play soccer? You might as well go to the school that's going to help you the best in the best possible way to achieve your goals. You've got Lawrence Livermore Labs and all of that connected to Berkeley, and that's probably his pathway. Why give that up for something that's not going to be your career for the rest of your life? But he doesn't want to give up his outlet. And his outlet and his love for the game is still strong. So he's playing club soccer at Berkeley. And there is, you don't have to compromise everything. You just might have to compromise something. But you
Well,
don't have to
so
compromise everything. And frankly, it's almost childish in some ways, where some of these kids are, well, if I can't have everything, then I'll have nothing. And it
Well,
doesn't have to be that way.
so we host a national invitational in the spring, and we go down to Orange County, and I actually cried at the one this year. I want to say it was Santa Clara. So Santa Clara's men's team is playing. They score. They run over to the sideline, and the women's team was watching their women's club team was watching the game. They jump up, they're filming, they're running down the sideline filming. And I looked at it and I said, this is everything, every reason why I started a club at Chico State, because I was teaching soccer classes. I was saying, how come, like when a kid was like, hey, can we start a club team? I said, how, yes. How come you're not playing on the first team? You got talent. But they were engineers. They were, construction management, whatever it was. But watching them celebrate like they had just scored the game-winning goal for the World Cup, and they're representing their school, and they're not doing it for accolades. They're not doing it for endorsements. They just love the game. And so I
Love it.
always I Cal is a unique one, but a lot of these teams are they're not just self-funded. They are self-ran. They figure out how they're getting from A to B. They're figuring out what fundraisers they need to do. They're figuring out what's the practice schedule. So they're doing all the nitty-gritty, the details that you do as a youth coach. They're doing it as college students, and they're trying to manage their peers, which is probably the hardest thing you can possibly do. Anybody who's been a part of a fraternity or sorority, right? You probably understand a little bit of the give and take that goes along with that. And I always tell people, our organization was a fraternity and sorority of soccer. And everybody here was playing because they loved to play and they wanted to represent their school. And at the end of the day, everyone who goes into, within your organization that you've talked to, one of the key factors is school representation matters. And if you were to ask any high school senior what game had more of an emotional pull on them, their last club game or their last high school game? And I would venture to say, without knowing it, that a majority would say their last high school game because it's around their peers, their best friends. Is the quality of the soccer lower? Yes, but that doesn't matter. I don't remember very many club games. I remember the big high school games where I'm representing. And when you make a mistake, you hear about it in homeroom the next day. You score the goal, you hear about it at homeroom the next day. And I'll leave you with this because I know we're running a little long. I
No,
was
that's fine. We're good. Talk as long as you want.
so I was a senior in high school. We're playing one of our rival teams. All of and anybody who's from Northern California or knows anything about high school football, De La Salle had the day off, and they were in the stands. And De La Salle had maybe five or six guys who played on my club team who were in the stands. So they're my friends, but they're watching. Voting against me, if you will. So last 5 minutes, it's 1-1. We get a free kick just outside the box, and I go to line up the kick. Well, this just happened to be when all the cheerleaders were taking their portraits and photos behind the goal I was about to shoot at, and I remember lining up the ball and thinking, please don't sky it over and definitely don't hit somebody, right? Like, this is like everybody's watching, my friends who I'm going to see for the next 12 months, all these other people, big, and I shoot and I score. And I run to the corner flag. I mean, I think I did a little shimmy salsa dance. And as I turned to go back to midfield, there was a grate covered with grass, and I stepped in this hole and twisted my ankle hard. And I stepped hard, like the ground was there and it wasn't there. So I'm down on the ground, my ankle's out. My dad was the coach, and he's like, "Hey, you got to get back in the game." I was like, "I can't go. I just did my ankle." He's like, "What are you talking about?" So anyway, we had the trainer there, like, take a look at it. Yeah, you're done for the day. And I was out for a week or whatever. But I remember going back to club soccer after the season ended, and no one remembered that game-winning goal. No one. They only remembered that I got hurt in the celebration, and so it was like a running joke. So it's the give and take of that high school sport experience. I went to the school behind De La Salle, so Ignacio Valley, which is public school, definitely, lower income in comparison. When we played each other, we had what was called the Canal Cup. So there was a canal that separated the two schools. So we played over this, like it was a fake trophy, but it was a rivalry
Right.
that we could, or we played for. So all that said, I think the value of scholastic sport has a really high social value long term, right? And you can think of that in maybe, the football quarterback, living the glory days, as he stays in the community and tries to ride the tide. There's lots of big memories that go along with that. And I think to my point, competing for your university in any capacity, for your organization in any capacity, there's a high intrinsic self-worth value there, knowing that you're representing something that's bigger than you. And in modern society, we're me-focused, personal branding, not understanding that representing organizations, representing groups is really important. It's why being called up for the national team is so important, right? It's why we have in California, we have kids who represent youth national teams from all different countries, right? From Mexico, Honduras. I have one player who I worked with. He's now playing for Indonesia, right? He's from the Bay Area, playing for Indonesia. So I think the more as you go through this experience, look to play, you know, that we have dream schools, right? My dream school was UCLA and Ziggy Schmidt, right? And but I was the same year as Sean Sakiris and Carlos Bocanegra and Nick Raimondo. And so I went to a camp and Ziggy and the staff are like, you're good, but you're not UCLA good. Like you'll have to,
Right.
you know, I can't even remember the center back's name, but there was a walk-on who like ended up being a captain and starter, but they're like, you're not gonna play for 3 years. Like it's gonna be a trial. So instead of going to UCLA, I went to LMU, smaller division, smaller school, a little bit different, and I played there. So I still ended up in Los Angeles, but not necessarily at my dream school. And you know, if there was a club soccer environment at, when I was there, I probably would have gone to UCLA and played club soccer versus going to LMU based on the
Right.
cost, you know, based on the cost. So there's
Right,
opportunities
right.
out there. And I will say, anybody who's looking at the college experience, go where you will not have debt once you graduate or very shortly thereafter. I cannot emphasize that enough as somebody who leveraged their future to go to a university that was outside of my family's price range. It took me a long time to pay off that student loan debt. And find an environment where you're not, you get the what you need from your university experience, but also that you're ready to take steps forward in your adult life. And if you have that debt, it can be crippling. So don't look at the entire package and what that means for you. And if whatever you're studying, get a minor in business. I'll tell you right now, that's the one thing I regret, going to a business school. No background in business. Now that I go into entrepreneurship and I'm having to hire people to do things that maybe I would have known how to do, you know, myself. So
I man, that is just fantastic advice. That really is. And I often describe searching for college. I say you're shopping, and if you cannot afford a Lamborghini, then stop test driving Lamborghinis and window shopping for Lamborghinis. And you can probably get a loan for a Lamborghini, but your payments are going to be $1,500 a month, and maybe you can even at that point only afford a lease. That's crazy. If you can only afford a Volkswagen, then shop for Volkswagens. And there's plenty of Volkswagens out there and Hondas out there that will serve all of your needs and you will love a lot and will really provide a lot of memories for you. It doesn't have to be the most expensive. You don't have to be shopping for a Maybach. For Pete's sake, what are we doing out there? But there's families out there that can afford a Maybach and can write a check for $100,000 a year to Baylor University, and it doesn't even put a dent in their bank account. And that's perfectly fine too. Every individual is different. And I think your advice applies to probably 98% of the people in the country. So I think that's really sound, really, really sound advice.
Well, young parents, I would say invest in something to support that college experience early, right? And whether it's $10 a week, you know, whatever you can do, squirrel something away for when your children get to that point where you want them to start their life, where they can start at something bigger than zero. And, you know, we spend a lot of money on a lot of things that we don't necessarily need. I can tell you, as a youth who grew up with a, you know, a family that need that had a lot of support, we worked in the barter system in my house. But getting your a leg up for your child and then teaching them financial responsibility, teaching them how to take what they have to get to what they want. And that it's going to take work. You can't buy your way out of problems. You can only use that. So, yeah, I think, you
Well,
know,
boy, I don't
it's
want to go before we talk a little bit more about your project, and I want people to know how they can get a hold of you and all of that. So, what exactly are the projects that you've started? You've talked about how you hire kids out of college and stuff. Describe to people because it's going to give ideas to other people around the country that are listening.
Yeah. So I work with an organization called the National Academy of Athletics. It's a Parks and Rec in after school extended care and also in service educational program for elementary. So it's focused really on TK K through five, creating sport opportunities. It's multi-sport, so it's really just getting kids active in and to complement what the physical education that is no longer supported in many schools is able to do. What we're looking to do is build our team to go in and working with schools and communities, doing camps, clinics, consistent PE, going through a sport-based curriculum. So it's really kind of an outreach type of program, which, for me and what I see the biggest need, it's how I got started. And so I'm going back to how I got started because I just see it as the biggest need. Everybody wants to be a pro coach or work with the best. The reality is that just like that everybody can be a coach, and I want to worry about the 99% that can work in the industry. I want to work with the 95% that need to learn how to be active, healthy, happy, and enjoy sport as a spectator and as a in a physical sense. So that's number one. With the so US College Club Soccer is the organization. There's the college club organization that we help run and operate, which will continue to grow as we develop that infrastructure. It supports college sport and especially student athletes who are going to schools and want to compete at an intercollegiate level. And so we have not just my league, the West Coast Soccer Association, but other leagues throughout the country that are combining in and playing more competitive local versus national travel. And then within all of that, the ASC Midtown, so Athletic Sport Club Midtown, that's really the more competitive side of what we're looking to do with National Academy of Athletics, is once we find and identify kids who are interested in being, in organizing a little bit more, is bringing together athletes of different sports. I'm more focused on futsal based, but worried with working with urban children in urban areas that gets them out and playing and gets them out of the house, trying to facilitate, open play, and try and keep it as low cost as possible, really for the community. So those are probably the three biggest projects going in. I do club development and club consultation as well. So going into clubs and helping them do what I've done with several clubs in terms of understanding
Right.
who you are, what you're doing, and then some possible ways to streamline or improve. So there's that as well. So that's more of a consultant-based thing that going in and looking to see what you have in your community and where your strengths are and where those opportunities that you may or may not see based on your resources. So
How many different clubs have you worked with?
just start out. So
Okay.
from going through this is really the clubs that I've worked with as an employee and now
Right.
employing at in using the structures that we created in the different clubs and environments, what applies to each group. So whether it's an internal coach development project or player performance pathways or college mentorship or just individual coach training. So a lot of different avenues. Each club has different strengths and higher priority needs. So with all of that, it's going in and seeing, where's your biggest pain point that you want to make strides forward? And in most cases, it's cultural, right? So it's developing the club culture to match the club environment you're looking for. And interesting enough, I'm seeing more and more independent organizations, so not formalized clubs and leagues, doing a really good job of creating a culture, but it's also very independent, right? So it's not really attached to other things. So linking those up with the more formalized organizations as well, because I think everybody, we're not competing. When you're working with children and you're working in education, you're not competing against somebody else, you're competing with somebody else. So I think it's
Right.
really important that we learn from each other, we collaborate as much as possible, because whether my club has 1,000 members or 950 members or 1,050 members, it's still an organization. And however many that I have in my organization, my job is to serve them during their time as a member, right?
Right.
And I think clubs, in balancing budgets and promising employment to individuals, sometimes we forget that it's all about the kids that we have, and we work with who's in front of us. So we can't complain about the five kids who aren't there. We have to
Right.
work with the 10 that are, right?
Right.
How do you maximize that? And how do you mentally not get in a bad headspace as a coach? And I see this all the time. We talk about the things that we don't have as opposed to optimizing the things we do. That goes for
Right.
coaches, that goes for players. Stop thinking about how what you can't do. Start really focusing on what you do well and go all in on that while acknowledging and working on the other things. But don't cry a river over the things you don't have. Right? 5'6", I wasn't good in the air. Right? I still remember playing against Carlos Bocanegra, and he skied up on a corner, scored the game winner against me when I was 16. Right? That was a bad assignment. There's no way Carlos Bocanegra, 6'2", should have been marked by Greg Rubendahl, 5'6".
Right.
But that was our mistake. But I took it personally. Like, it was my assignment. It was not my job to do that job, though. So
Right.
can I complain? Like, I was, and maybe we're organized better. That doesn't happen. So I think as we go through, play to your strengths, right? Know what you can do, play to your strengths, find support, ask for help, and put your ego at the door. When you're working with other people's kids, put your ego, it's not about you. And if you're getting into this and it's about you and your career primarily, then you're really missing the joy that comes from helping somebody get to their dream. And I always tell people, like, I'm living my dream. I'm already doing what I love to do. So I'm in the dream making business now, because I'm in my dream, working with the right people. So
If I'm starting a club out there, or if I have a club that I think needs to take the next level, I'm reaching out to you and getting your opinion and talk about what it would take to get your, because you've got a lot of experience, and people, anybody listen to this all the way to the end here, understands that you've got a lot of experience to share, and why not learn from somebody else's mistakes, and you don't have to go make them yourself.
I think at the end of the day, everybody needs coaching. Like, I have a personal coach that I work with, I have my team, but I have a personal coach, somebody who knows nothing about soccer, but knows about, the needs that I have. So I hired somebody to be my coach. I think everybody needs coaching, and especially when you get into directorships and, board of directors may or may not have that leadership guidance for you, and there may not be trust issues, is finding somebody to be your coach, and somebody who's consistent, not just somebody to have a coffee with, but somebody who's really invested in helping you progress. And I think that's at every level. When you stop learning and stop trying to grow, that's probably the last day you should have that job position. So you always should be trying to grow and improve in the areas that are going to help make more impact, but also just give value to what you're doing. Right? Because if not, you'll get caught up in the weeds.
That's good advice, man. I appreciate it. How do people get a hold of you, Greg?
Yeah, so you can find me, email me. I have, and I'll send the socials, so LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, my email, gnr.coaching@gmail.com. I've got a lifestyle brand that's coming out, Hella Football Consortium. So I'll just throw
All
that in
right.
there, but it's a more
Look forward to
anybody from
that.
Northern California, Hella FC, which was the brainchild over the pandemic. But it's an affiliation and a lifestyle of bringing people who are in Northern California in sport all of us individual pirates who do a great job and work for companies, but also understand our value individually, just linking everybody together and having a bigger business page. So find me on that. Again, thank you for having me. I always love talking sport. I can talk a lot, and sometimes I jump around a little bit. So,
Love it.
but
No, a lot of good information here, brother. And you've touched on some topics that we've never really talked about here on Inside College Soccer. So, and for everybody out there, look, Greg's info will be in the bio section of the episode description of this, and we'll make sure that all of his links are there, and you'll be able to get a hold of him, reach out to him, and thanks everybody, and appreciate you coming on, Greg.
yeah, no problem. Thanks, Don. Have a great day.